And good morning again. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It is 8:06 on your Monday morning and the last week of December 2025. Let's find out what's in store for our weather this coming week. On the phone, we have Cedric Hayes, our favorite weather guy from ABC4.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. I'll tell you what, we're waking up to some frigid temperatures out there to kick off the new week here as temperatures are well down into the teens, even a couple of single digits in some spots. It's going to be another chilly day today as we see plenty of sunshine. High temperatures climb into the mid-30s for us in Park City this afternoon. We'll see those highs climbing to around 40 degrees in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Tuesday, look for lots of sunshine. Another frigid start to the day with temperatures down into the teens and low 20s there for us in both the Heber Valley and in Park City. But as we go throughout the day, we'll see those numbers rebounding a little bit more with lots of sunshine. We'll see those highs climbing into the mid-40s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the mid to upper 40s for us in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Wednesday, we start to see a few changes arriving. That, of course, is your New Year's Eve. We'll be looking at a mixture of sun and clouds, a few more clouds into the afternoon hours after a chilly start to the day with temperatures into the teens and 20s to kick off the day. We'll see those highs warming up into the upper 40s in Park City, highs right around 50 in the Heber Valley. As we head into the new year, as the clock strikes midnight, we should be looking at mostly cloudy skies, mainly dry conditions, but we will bring in the chance of showers as we go into your New Year's Day. So look for off and on periods of showers on your New Year's Day in the Heber Valley. Temperatures only in the mid to upper 40s for highs. In Park City, we'll be looking at some of those showers as well off and on throughout the day at temperatures climbing into the low 40s. There's a chance of a couple of snowflakes mixing in for elevations above about 7,500 feet as we go into your New Year's Day, but this will be another mild storm system, so most of this precipitation that falls will be liquid. We'll see another chance of off and on rain showers developing as we go into your Friday and Saturday, so some unsettled conditions, and we may wrap it up with a little snow potentially by the time we get towards your Sunday in Park City, with a rain-snow mix potentially by the time we get towards your Sunday in the Heber Valley. Overall, a dry, winter-like feel to kick off the week, but we will see more active weather returning for the middle and latter half of the week, right on into the upcoming weekend. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Hayes.
This weather report is brought to you in part by ABC4 Utah, ABC4.com, and Deer Valley Resorts, DeerValley.com. Thanks for that, Cedric. We have our fingers crossed that a little snow is coming our way. And now let's find out what all the weather's going to mean for the backcountry. On the phone, we have the Utah Avalanche Center with the outlook for the start of the week.
Yeah, good morning. Certainly temperatures feel more appropriate for late December. We've had such a warm November in through December until recently. This cold weather is a nice break, feels more appropriate for winter, and we have some sunshine. And the weekend storm, began Friday night into Saturday, has left about 10 to 12 inches of settled snow. That was on top of that rain crust that we got this past Christmas Day. So it's kind of a complicated snowpack structure that we have right now. So we are going with an overall moderate avalanche danger at the mid and upper elevations. Now, yesterday, there were 4 human-triggered avalanches reported from the backcountry. 3 of the avalanches involved where the rider was caught and carried in the avalanche. Fortunately, no full burials and no injuries. And these first 3 avalanches I'm describing, these are in upper Little Cottonwood Canyon. They were on a southeast aspect, and I suspect that slope was somewhat wind-loaded from the northwest winds. So when winds blow from the northwest, it's the windward side. The leeward side, southeast, is where the wind is deposited. So I think there was some wind involved. The avalanche that really got my attention, though, was on Sunset Peak. This is between Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon. This was on a north aspect at 10,300 feet. And it was up to 3 feet deep in places, and it ran on our persistent weak layer, the thing we've been talking about all season long. So moderate avalanche danger today. The two primary problems, again, are pretty much on any aspect at the mid and upper elevations involving new snow, especially snow that's been recently wind drifted. But also keep in mind that on elevations above about 9,000 feet, we have this persistent weak layer. We've been talking about it all season long. We've capped it with that rain crust from Christmas, and that has really just complicated things. The snowpack along the Park City Ridgeline, for example, is quite weak. We have that persistent weak layer. And in field tests and everything, we're seeing full propagation with extended column tests. So that tells us that a slope where you have that persistent weak layer and you have the right slab on top, there's a propensity for an avalanche. It'll be, again, breaking up to 3 feet deep. So fortunately, the recent storm snow has left some great riding conditions on all aspects at the mid and upper elevations. And you don't have to get on steeper slopes to enjoy this new snow. And that's about it for us.
Well, thanks very much. Sounds like moderate danger, but still be careful out there.
Oh, you got it summarized perfectly. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
And that was the Utah Avalanche Center with our start to the week. Coming up on the local news hour, again, we'll be talking with the Utah Forestry, Fire, and State Lands Director about a new state law to mitigate wildfire risk and deal with insurance issues. And we'll hear about the National Christmas Bird Count from Tanya Kiefer-Selby, and finish the hour with a conversation with outgoing Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson, who is leaving public service after 8 years in office. A new law that takes effect January 1 will require some homeowners to pay more if they live in high-risk fire zones. KPCW's Connor Thomas sat down with the director of Utah Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, Jamie Barnes, to talk about House Bill 48 and how it will mitigate fire risk and insurance issues.
We're here with the state forester, director of Utah Forestry, Fire, and State Lands, Jamie Barnes. Thanks so much for calling in.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here.
The reason we wanted to have you on at the end of the year here is starting January 1st, state law called House Bill 48 is going to go into effect. It's kind of aimed at, you know, helping mitigate wildfire risk and insurance issues across the state. Could you maybe explain a little bit more about, in general, what this law is aimed to do? It's going to have some implications for fees for a lot of homeowners.
Yeah, so this law is an approach that the legislature took, really looking at those high-risk wildland-urban interface areas and really getting to know what exactly is in those high-risk wildland-urban interface areas with regard to structures and communities and what that true risk is. And then also, as you know, especially this last year, we saw a pretty good fire season here in Utah. A lot of structures that were burned or at risk during that season. And then for the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen issues around insurance and insuring communities or homes within these high-risk areas. And so this bill takes to task the insurance issues, the risk in those communities, and shared responsibility and how we can start mitigating fuels in those high-risk areas and start reducing the risk of wildfire in those communities. Also to bring about keeping insurance in those areas, and then also notifying homeowners of what the educational responsibility of wildfire risk around their homes should be done and how it should be done, and then also how that can play into keeping your insurance rates down and keeping insurance in general.
Of course, you didn't pass the state law. That's the legislature. But your agency is in charge of implementing this. And just in case we slip into the jargon in the interview, if people hear the term WUI, that's this wildland urban interface that folks in your industry talk about, the place where development meets, I suppose, forest or desert wild areas. The map that you recently published identifies what's most at risk. Can you explain to people, if they go to your website, what they're looking at when they see this map?
Yeah, so the division's been mapping risk for years, you know, 10 plus years, saying this is the risk to communities based on wildfire. This is a new approach where we took looking at risk based on high-risk wildland urban interface areas. So the map calculates risk by looking at severity, probability, and exposure, where fire behavior is quantified as fuels, weather, and topography. And then it also incorporates the physical exposure of fire, which includes direct contact, convection, and radiation surrounding wildland fuels from ember production for these fuels. And this is a key component of assigning an exposure score. So that's really what we're looking here, is what is the exposure to those structures based on embers. So when you go to that map, what you're really going to be looking for, if you're looking to determine if you're in that high-risk wildland urban interface area, or WUI as we call it, is that layer on that map that's identified as the high-risk WUI map. So go in there. You can type in your address on the toolbar. There's a demonstration of how that can be done. And then going in and seeing if your structures on your property are fall within that area. If your structures on your property fall within that area, those are the structures, according to the legislation, that are subject to a fee.
Yes. We'll have links to all this on our website as well. I'll be honest, looking at the map in a vacuum, it can look a little bit random, all these red dots across the state. When I first loaded it, though, it looks like you've got a separate layer that looks just at exposure of buildings, as you just described. Is that other layer helpful for interpreting the high-risk WUI map? Because it seems like some of those red dots follow some of the contours of the map that assesses, you know, levels of exposure in Utah.
Yeah, I mean, that can definitely be helpful. I think right now, you know, what I've seen being put out online, and it's easy for people to become confused. It's easy for people to become confused and say, the division has painted the entire state red. Now everyone is in the high-risk WUI. That's not the case. Really what you need to pay attention to is that small amount of the state that is in the high-risk WUI. So turning off that structure exposure score map or that burn probability map and just focusing on that high-risk WUI map is really the key if this is what you're looking for. Now, if you're looking to assess other fire risks within the state, those other layers of the map are definitely helpful. But if you're simply worried about HB 48, what are the implications because of this bill, then focus in on that high-risk WUI map, because really there's few areas of the state, when you look at the state as a whole, that are in the high-risk WUI area.
And just to sort of rehash, you know, you looked at exposure, and you're only looking at structures, not empty plots of land, I guess, and those structures have to have two or more neighboring structures within about, I think it's 820 feet proximity. Could you explain why 800 feet and where some of those numbers came from?
Yeah, so that was done off of the scientific model that we used for the calculations that were developed based on that model. And so that's how we ran that model for this. It was done out of a study out of HB 437, and that's how the study was ran. So that's how the model ran across the fuelscape, and that's how we determined that high-risk WUI boundary.
And at the very least, the models, the exposure formula, that's standard across the whole state. So it's apples to apples with different structures in Utah?
Right. And that's part of the point of this bill, was really to create standardized mapping. As you go through and you read the bill, you will notice that the insurance companies are required to use this boundary created in that high-risk WUI layer for us analyzing data for insurance. And so they can use other tools also, but when it comes to high-risk WUI, they're required to use the state's map to determine if someone is in the high-risk WUI. We've seen a lot of controversy in maps. There's a lot of maps out there. There's a lot of data out there. And so one of the reasons for this bill was to create standardization and to say, in Utah, when you're looking at insurance and when you're looking at risk, this should be the map, has to be the map that is used to determine if someone is in the high-risk WUI.
Yeah, and I know you're not the agency that drafted the bill necessarily, but it seems like there are trade-offs with this. If you create this map, it may make some properties seem more insurable. They're not within the high-risk WUI, but for those that are, it could be, I don't know, it could hurt their chances of getting insurance or raise their costs.
Yeah, and I've heard a lot of that lately. We've had, you know, concerned people saying, you know, now that this map is going to be put out, my insurance company is going to know that I'm in the high-risk WUI. And the reality of that is, your insurance company already knows if you live in the high-risk WUI. The hopes of the bill is, and what we believe will happen now, is it's created a standardized platform of the whole entire state is not painted red. We've identified those high-risk WUI areas. We know now where those high-risk WUI areas are, but the real thing to focus on is the risk. So how can we now go in and do lot assessments that are voluntary by, you know, the communities and the property owners and really focus on that risk? People have to realize that this is a shared responsibility. And I think our deputy state fire management officer says it best when he says the best firefighter is the property owner that does work before the fire hits. So really focusing in on where that work can be done. The division will come in. We will do lot assessments. That's part of the fee that you pay. The fees are minimal. They're not punitive in nature. But we'll come in and we'll assess and we'll say, here's what needs to be done on your property to reduce that risk of wildfire in your area. So really focusing in on that and the true need of what needs to happen will make your property less vulnerable to wildfire. And if that time comes when a fire pops off in that area, it's hopeful that your structure will not burn.
Yeah, let's talk more about some of the responsibilities that homeowners or structure owners have under this bill. If I have a building, I need to get it assessed every so often, not annually, but pretty frequently. Who do I call? Who's allowed to do that assessment? Which assessment counts under this bill, and how often?
Yeah, so the division will come in and do that assessment. We will be training people throughout the state that are certified to do that assessment. The reason for the training and the certification to do those is to create, again, a standardized process to make sure that everyone's getting a fair assessment and we're, you know, not leaving any gaps in that. So the division will work with the counties, hopefully. We have the right to delegate this to a county. We definitely won't be putting this on the county and saying this is your responsibility, but hopefully that's a partnership with the counties, wherein the counties can also train people within their purview to go out and do these assessments. And then it's voluntary for the property owners to enter into the assessment if they want to do that. It's to their advantage, honestly, for us to come out and spend some time on that property and tell them the things that we would recommend that they do. And those assessments can be done. They need to be done annually. Then if work's completed, we can come back out and check that work.
And of course, you don't pay per visit. It's covered by that annual fee that will start to be assessed sort of on a flat basis, adjusted for your structure's square footage over the next 2 years. And then change based on the risk that those assessments find or don't find on your property after that?
Correct, yeah. So, you know, if we triage that and they're in a, you know, high risk in the high risk wildland urban interface area and they want to get their property down to low risk in that WUI area, then it's to their advantage to have us come out and do that assessment so they can reduce their risk, which will also in turn reduce their fee. So that is one of the advantages of having an assessment done.
Have you decided how much the fees will be?
Right now, we're still working on the fees. We've been working in coordination with the counties and how they're going to assess that through their database. And one thing we want to remind people is this is not a county-imposed fee. This is a state fee that is being assessed through the county, but nothing to do with the county. But right now, we're looking at a minimum of $20 and a maximum of $100. So like I say, not punitive in nature.
And that's on an annual basis?
That's correct.
And total, or is it like $20? It's not $20 per square foot, is it?
No. That would be total.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you're going to be writing a check to the county treasurer that gets passed through to the Utah Wildfire Fund. Is that still the plan?
Yeah. So the county collects the fee. They're allowed to keep a portion of that fee based on what their costs are to collect that. And then they pass that money back to the division. The fees are simply to implement the program under HB 48. Now, that program consists of that mapping tool that we talked about, those lot assessments that we talked about. We anticipate right now there's about anywhere from 60 to 62,000 structures in that high-risk area. So you know, basically everyone's entitled to a law assessment on those structures. And so that's a big task to stand up that program and get that done. So that's what that fee goes to.
Do you think you're going to get enough money to cover the labor of all the assessments that you're going to have to do?
Yeah, it's hard to say right now what the cost of that program is and how many people will actually want assessments. So the first couple of years, it's defining what that program actually looks like and what the cost of that is. One thing the division will not do, as we've heard a lot of angst over that, is that we will continue to increase the fees to cover the cost of the program. We will keep the fees at a minimum. This isn't a program that's meant to be, like I said, punitive to property owners for living in that area. This is more of a program that's meant to address the risk in the high-risk areas and also an educational and shared responsibility program. The overall goal of the program is to start to address insurance issues and start to address and mitigate those fuels issues that we have in these areas.
Did state lawmakers talk with forestry, fire, and state lands about what you wanted to see in this bill or what would be helpful in it as far as administering it? Any consultation before it came out?
Yeah, there was consultation on this bill, definitely. You know, as we moved through the process, and there was friendly consultation with insurance, there was friendly consultation with the division. Overall, the process was very positive.
I mean, as we move into the next general session in January of 2026, any changes that you'd like to see or any changes that you expect to see based on some of the public feedback on the first iteration?
Yeah, you know, I always get nervous when we open a bill back up because right now we know what we have and we've been working within the confines and the parameters of that bill knowing what we have. This has been a big program to stand up. I personally don't have any changes right now. We've came out with an expectation of what we were asked to do by the legislature, and we respect that, and we've moved full steam ahead to get that set up. So, but we'll see if something comes about this year. Wildfire is always a big topic in the legislature, especially with the cost of wildfire and the increasing severity of wildfire across the state. So it's possible that something could move this year to change something or something new, but I haven't heard of anything at this point.
Okay, well, maybe this is changing subjects, maybe it isn't, but, you know, we don't have any snow in the mountains. So, you know, what are you thinking for next wildfire season? I know that's a bit of a misnomer more and more as the earth gets warmer, but what are you looking ahead to come summer 2026?
Yeah, well, right now, it concerns me. It's December, it's almost the Christmas holiday, and it in some areas of the state, it feels like spring. So that's one of the things that plays into a bill like this is the mitigation of fuels. And honestly, that's what I want people to focus on is the continued drought, the continued dry fuels, the continued increase of fuels, that we've got to work together on decreasing the amount of fuels on the landscape, especially those hazardous fuels that carry that fire. So, you know, it's hard to say, as you said, right now it's too early to say what fire season will bring next year, but overall, it's something that concerns me when we're not getting a heavy snowpack, but I hope that we start to get a little more moisture and we start to see some snowpack. Otherwise, we could possibly be in for it again next year.
Director Jamie Barnes from Utah's Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands. Thank you so much again for calling in.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And good morning again. We're back on the local news hour. We got a surprise early visit from outgoing Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson. So we're going to switch up our interview schedule a bit this morning. Good morning, Celeste. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And congratulations on your 8 years of mayor.
Thank you.
How are you feeling about leaving?
You know, it is a mixed bag of emotions, I can tell you. There are days when I feel a little bit depressed, and there are days when I'm like, oh, I'm glad Craig gets to deal with that one. So it's a little bit of everything.
Yes. Well, so I went back and listened to your local news hour interview from back in 2017, maybe early 18, when you first got elected. And back then you were talking a lot about the need to preserve open space. And it seems like that's been a theme throughout your 8 years. Can you talk about why that was important?
That was so important to me and it's interesting because my opinion about it has evolved and gotten actually even more ingrained and deeper. Initially, open space, the idea of preserving it was just to protect Midway from overgrowth and overdevelopment and to keep spaces open for the lifestyle that people move to Midway for, which is the hiking and the biking and all the trails and so forth. I have evolved into a better understanding of what we were really doing was saving farmland. And those lands are still being farmed, they're still being used, and that's really important. We saw in 2020 with the pandemic, a supply chain crisis of sorts. And it really occurred to me that if we had to grow our own food literally and take care of ourselves, if everything is houses, where do we farm? And by saving these farms, we have protected a way that we can take care of ourselves. It's interesting. Midway has a sister city in Switzerland called Trubschachen, and I became friends with that mayor, and he asked me one day what our biggest challenge was, and I said, well, having development not overtake us, and how can we be careful about that? And he said, well, what percentage of your land do you have to save for farming? And I said, what do you mean, what percentage? And they have very clear laws about that over there for this very reason. And it is one of those things that really helped me understand we're not just saving open spaces for view corridors. We're genuinely protecting farmland and grazing land. And that is something that down the road could be critical.
And you're really also preserving the history of the community, those families who have been there for generations, building Midway from the very beginning. They're able to continue, you know, their way of life.
Yes, and it is so important that we acknowledge those early settlers and those early families who really created this magical town that we now call Midway. And by protecting that, by making sure that those landowners have an option, they don't have to sell to a developer. They can do a conservation easement. They get paid for that conservation easement. And it gives them a way to be able to keep their farm and to say thank you for doing what you've done all these many years.
So let's talk in dollars about how much Midway has spent on preserving open space since you took office.
So our first open space bond was for $5 million. We passed another one last year for another $5 million. We have spent that first $5 million, or have committed it, I should say. We have not yet released the second $5 million. Once we do that, then we have to start paying interest, obviously. So our open space committee is being very careful. And as soon as this first $5 million is, in fact, completely spent, we will open up that second.
So that has to be a really a benchmark moment in your career in office, because I know you were talking about open space even before you were mayor. So you must feel really proud about the successes.
I'm very proud of it. I'm very proud of our community. This is something that we had to come together for. And the thing that's exciting about an open space bond, excuse me, my morning voice, the thing that's exciting about an open space bond is that it's something that goes on the ballot. The people get to vote on this. So the first open space bond was pretty tight. I think it passed by about 53%, but our second one passed by 71%. In today's world, 71% is practically unanimous. So
right.
I think
amazing.
Folks understood what it was we were trying to do.
So what other issues or challenges became important along the way? What roadblocks did you face, if any?
Yeah, I think what's really, there's a couple of things. First of all, Midway is a charming town that is very close to an airport on down either canyon. So we're uniquely positioned to be discovered, right? And you can live in Midway and have this historic rural living experience. We're surrounded by 23,000 acres of Wasatch State Park. You know, all of these things that are so unique. But in 40 minutes, you can be in downtown Salt Lake or downtown Provo and get to an airport. So we're uniquely positioned as a result of that we've been discovered, right? So being able to channel our growth appropriately has been very important. Along with being discovered, we've got parking issues now. We've got traffic issues. I chuckle and yet I'm concerned at the same time. So one of my number one complaints is that we've got speeders. Our traffic speed limit in Midway is basically 25 miles an hour. We do traffic studies constantly and it shows that 85% of our traffic is going 35 miles an hour or slower. So we talk to traffic engineers and we say, you know, we've got a speeding problem. And they look at this data and they say, no, you don't. No, you don't. This is actually incredibly safe. And we've got communities that would kill for these kinds of numbers. So we want everyone to just slow down and enjoy that rural kind of a feeling, but the perception is that there's a lot of cars. Mm-hmm. So we have to plan for that too.
I feel like in Utah there's a lot more cars.
Yes, I agree.
Than yeah. there have been even in the last 5 years.
Yep.
I think you also had a challenge with Rocky Mountain Power at one point wanted to build some power lines through town. How did that go?
Yeah. Oh gosh, that was a nightmare. And and it was probably my most difficult, frustrating, discouraging thing to be involved with as a mayor. The citizenry really believed that we could stop this project. And what you learn is that power lines have to be built and power has to be able to be provided to all communities. And what that means is that they may have to run power lines through your community. Doesn't serve your community necessarily. It's getting from point A to point D, and you might be point B and a half. And it's very discouraging, but I tried to remind Midway residents, look, our power is coming from Southern Utah or from Wyoming or wherever. It's traveling through communities just like ours to get to us. So they obviously, what we didn't want was great big huge power lines, a great big big city look. We wanted the power lines to be buried. Rocky Mountain Power doesn't bury power lines. You have to pay for that.
Oh, and that's
and
super expensive.
Very expensive. The small little section that we were looking at would have cost $12 million.
Where does Midway come up with an extra $12 million?
Right. It's just not realistic.
You also mentioned COVID and some of the COVID challenges. What was your approach to leading Midway through the pandemic?
You know, we were really lucky. Wasatch Health Department really took the lead on this, and the community came together and followed that lead. So while we did have some outlier voices and people that were unhappy about some of the rules that were being made, I would say 80% at least of the community got behind this. And we met weekly. This is what we're going to do. We all agreed. So it did involve things like requiring masks in stores and keeping space and social distancing and so forth. The one thing I'm really proud of is that one of our city council members, Jeff Drury, approached me and he said, look, we're going to be getting tranches of money from the government to help businesses. Let's make this as easy as possible to get this money out to our businesses. So the second we got that money, we let all, and this is the beauty of being a small community, right? We got all of our businesses together on a Zoom call. We said, this is what all you have to do. Fill out this 5-question form. Tell us what you need. Give us dollar amounts. We'll reconvene in a week and we'll pass out all the money. And that's exactly what we did.
Do you think you learned something important about community and talking to each other and how to communicate?
Yes. Yes. Talking and working together is so important. And divisiveness means you don't get things done. Coming together, even in compromise, means you get things done.
So two quick last questions. What do you think you learned about yourself in 8 years? And what are you going to do next?
Those are two magic questions. What I learned is that I do have an ability to talk to people and to bring people together and to find solutions. And I was excited to learn that about myself, that I could coordinate that and, for the most part, keep people happy. What I'm going to do next is to stay very involved in my community. So I will be involved with the Wasatch Community Foundation. I will continue working with the Wasatch Caring Coalition, as well as the Boulder Way Forward.
Well, Celeste, thanks so much for being here, and congratulations on a successful 8 years, and good luck in the next part of your adventure.
Thank you so much, and thanks to KPCW.
And we're back. Grace had a great conversation with Tanya Kiefer-Selby of the Division of Wildlife Resources about their tradition.
Hello, I'm KBCW's Grace Dorfler. I'm talking with the DWR's Northeastern Region Outreach Manager, Tanya Kiefer-Selby. Tanya, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're so welcome. Anything, you know, to do with birds is, you know, a good topic to discuss.
Excellent. We're here to talk about the Christmas bird count, which is a longstanding tradition across the country. Could you tell me, first of all, what exactly the Christmas bird count is?
So the Christmas bird count is a nationwide survey or count of birds. It's been going on for 126 years this year. And each of the counts basically takes place in an established 15-mile diameter circle. So these circles have been designated for, you know, however many years they have existed. And then volunteers will be given like specific zones of those 15-mile diameter circles, and they will go and they will count birds throughout an entire day. And then we total all the birds at the end of the day and report that back to the Audubon and to the Lab of Ornithology. And they are able to compute a lot of data and gather a lot of science from that. And so for 126 years, that's been something that has shown us a crazy amount of data with 3 billion birds declining. Like, this is the kind of thing that has helped contribute to that understanding and knowledge.
Whoa, so it's like a giant citizen science project every winter.
It's huge, yeah. The citizen science, community science, it's an incredible opportunity. It runs every year from December 14th until January 5th. If you go to Audubon's website and just type in, you know, Christmas bird count, it shows a map of any of the circles that you can become involved in. And the fun thing about birding is you don't have to be like an advanced birder. You can be a new birder and join up with, you know, maybe more advanced birding groups. And then, you know, just the different circles designate their certain days so that they're kind of stratified. Not everybody does their counts on the same day. You just have a 3-week period that you need to be counting the birds. That we anticipate those birds are going to be sticking around in that area. And so it's a really great opportunity to get outdoors, be, you know, if you're already, I mean, we may not be experiencing cabin fever here because it's too hot right now, but it's a really good opportunity to just get outside and really see, you know, the life that exists around you.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of how many people participate each year, and I guess maybe how many birds participate?
Oh my gosh. You know, I wish I kept up to date on how many people participate. I know that Audubon does send out a total at the end of the season saying we had X number of birders participate, and this is the number of species that we found. The summary, I think, from 2024-2025 says that they had, and I'm just quoting this straight from the website, 83,109 participants. There was 2,600 circles counted, 3,700 compilers that compiled the data, 21 countries, 42 brand new circles, and in just in 2025, 44 million birds were counted.
Wow, that's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah, it's crazy. Like, but when you have a giant, you know, citizen science, community science project like this ongoing, you know, you end up recruiting a lot of really great help. And that just last year, it says they, you know, added 40 new species. I mean, it's just crazy. Sometimes when you're in a circle, you don't see certain species, and that's not just because they don't maybe exist. It's just that they're not in that circle area. So to add 40 new species, that's pretty incredible. You know, with warmer winters like we're having, or at least that Utah's experiencing, we do end up with species that get knocked off course, or they're migrating and they just went down the wrong path. And so it's fascinating data. And like I said, a great opportunity to grab your family, grab your kids, make memories. Like, they're not going to remember video games, but going on a Christmas bird count, your kids are going to remember that.
Yeah. KPCW's in the Wasatch Back. Could you tell us a little bit about what opportunities people could get involved in this region of Utah?
So there are several Christmas bird counts going on, not necessarily in the Wasatch backup by Park City, but we do have a central location in central Utah near Provo that will be hosting a Christmas bird count on December 20th. And then I'm hosting one out here in the northeastern region on this Saturday, also December 20th. And then there are a couple others around the state. Like I said, if we can go or have folks go to the Audubon website, you can click on the link and it shows the map to which of the bird counts that you can become involved in. I don't remember. I don't know if there's any outside of Provo that's probably closest to you. On the back side. Now, on the front side of the Wasatch Front, you would have a few more opportunities for circles. Oh, Heber Valley might have one. It says Kathy Donnell, maybe on the 3rd of January. She works out at Wasatch Mountain State Park, as well as it looks like there's one. Well, there's not inconclusive data, so I won't give you the Park City one. It looks like there's somebody that may run it. So just keep looking. They may be updating the circle information. But like I said, if you get a hold of the gentleman that is listed on the Park City circle, you may be able to get involved with that one as well.
Good to know. And people can head to that Audubon website to find the closest one for them.
Yep. All they have to do is type in Christmas bird count and then just find a location on the map.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Utah's a big migratory flyway with the Great Salt Lake and everything that. What kind of trends are you noticing with our bird populations from doing this bird count over the years?
Well, this is I've been doing this for over 20 years and in Utah for the last 10. And the trends I see are with the warming weather, you don't get birds pushing down from maybe Canada and the territories north of us. They kind of stay just on the outskirts of where they need to be. Maybe they don't like the warmer weather as much as some, but we also see the migration of birds throughout the summertime. For instance, when we're getting hummingbirds moving through, and this year we saw hummingbirds moving through very early on, like in the early parts of July, and they'll stick around a little bit later just because it's warmer and they still have nectar sources. But that's the crazy thing that we see with this bird count over the years is just the varying amount of species that will be present in our circle. And then on a warmer year like this year, the ones that aren't. You know, some years you question, why didn't I get 20,000 mallards? Well, that's because we didn't get a polar push down from Canada to push those birds into our location. They're there probably somewhere else. And the data north of us should show an increase of those birds. And so it's fascinating to be able to take that data, compare it to others, and see maybe where, and speculate where your birds may be.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Is there any particular reason why we do the bird count around the Christmas season, around the holidays?
So this was a tradition started, like I said, 126 years ago. And the reason why it was started then was because this was the time of year that families and, workers would get together. And this started as hunting, as a hunting opportunity. And they noticed that there were large declines in the birds that they were hunting. And so when Audubon got together and created this group originally, it was so that we could start counting the population because they noticed that populations were, maybe not as abundant as they once were. That's why it's the Christmas season, because it's the time of year. Also, when it's cold out and the birds are gathered together and there's leaf off. So when you have leaves on the trees, it's a lot harder to see. Leaf off offers you the opportunity to see the birds a little bit more clearly.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And you've talked a little bit about this already, but how do scientists like ornithologists use the data that's gathered at the bird counts?
So ornithologists can use the data from these bird counts to help make wise conservation actions and management decisions based on, maybe population declines or increases. Some of the birds that we're currently studying in the state of Utah, we just don't have a lot of information about, and we don't have any, prior research that gives us a lot of data, for instance, on rosy finches, as well as, I think it's pinion jays. Anyway, those are two species that we're putting a lot of effort into, and it's just because we need to fill in the data gaps. We don't know a lot about the species, and we want to look into whether or not their populations are healthy, whether their populations are in decline. And so, we have the ability to take that data, assess whether or not we are seeing these declines, and if there are management decisions we can make to help that. From a wildlife agency standpoint, you know, we manage wildlife for the citizens of Utah and manage them for healthy populations. And so maybe that means that we're going to go into an area and try to increase better habitat or better nesting ground. Maybe there are certain, you know, habitat changes or, you know, environmental indications that we can help control so that we can help, you know, with populations, whether that's increase or decrease.
Gotcha. Thanks for explaining that.
Yeah, hopefully that makes sense.
I think so, yeah. You mentioned that you're a longtime birder. For anybody who might not be experienced or might be curious but not sure how to get started, what would you say to them?
I would say birding is the healthiest addiction that you can have. And all you have to do is walk into your backyard. You could benefit from having a pair of binoculars, but you don't need binoculars to be able to see birds. It helps. So if you could pick up a cheap pair of binoculars, great. If you can find a friend that likes to bird watch or has a pair of binoculars and maybe uses them for hunting, maybe not birding, see if you can borrow them and then go and look for a bird. And my challenge to you is go look for that bird, look at the different characteristics, look at its shape, its size, where you found it. Was it in a tree? Was it on the ground? You know, its colors. And then pick up a bird book. Most of our DWR offices have, you know, several bird books we could loan out if needed, but they're also not that expensive if you want to buy them on Amazon. You know, the Peterson's field guides, the Kaufman field guides, all wonderful field guides to have. And I challenge you to find one bird, open up one of those books and just identify it. And that, you know, if you are a competitive person, you essentially have less than 750 species, give or take, in the United States. And so if you like competition, you could compete with yourself to see whether or not you could actually find a bird and identify it properly. And so they also have, we have a new little competition in the state of Utah for advanced beginning birders, intermediate birders, and it's called the Utah Birding Slam. And this is a really great way, while these Christmas bird counts are going on this time of year, to get into birding. And so if you go to the Divisional Wildlife website at wildlife.utah.gov, type in Utah Birding Slam, you'll see that we have these opportunities for different birding levels to encourage you to get outside. It goes through the rules as to what we expect out of a birder to go out. Like I said, one of them is literally a beginner slam. You would download the eBird app on your phone. This is the way that the Cornell Lab of Ornithology has it's tracking most of your citizen science throughout the entire year. Christmas bird counts only happen at Christmas time, but eBird is the ability to track birds throughout the entire year, all over the world. And so for Beginner Slam, you just download that app and find one bird, and then you've completed an entire slam. It is a $20 registration for each of the six slams. So in order to get a pin for that, you would need to buy the registration first, do the Beginner Slam requirements, submit your information, and then we'll send you this really cool little pin that says, you're amazing, you've started this new journey, and we're really proud of you. And then you can compete with yourself to try and, you know, make your birding experiences a little bit harder. Try to advance a little bit more and a little bit more. I don't think any of us ever think we're ever complete experts, but, you know, it's a fun challenge to just make it all year round competitive, right? And this is a great way to do that.
Yeah, and I imagine once you've found one bird, you want to find another one.
It's addicting. It's so much fun. And birds come in such a variety of colors, and they sing so many wonderful songs. And it's not like most of the time, if you're not a birder, you would probably just never see it. But once you start birding, you start listening, you start looking, they're everywhere. And it becomes just... Now I've had the ability to travel to different countries, and I can just say, like, I'm so addicted to it. It's fun to even travel out of the country and see new birds. And just birds are, you know, they are something that are a way of life in every country, whether that is Antarctica, whether that is Australia, whether that is the United States. Like, birds unite people, and, you know, there are varying levels of conservation efforts that go into helping those birds. But, you know, it's just something that you can get your friends into, your family into. You can create lifelong memories by jumping into this sport, which is one of the fastest growing sports in the nation.
Well, hopefully some people take you up on that after hearing this conversation.
It's going to be so exciting. So I really hope that if anybody has any questions, you can contact any of the DWR regional offices, and we'll hopefully point you in the right direction.
Cool. My last question for you today, Tanya, as you're getting ready for your own bird count this year, are there any species you're most hoping to see?
Ooh, this is very exciting for me. Yes, we had a crested caracara, which is crazy because it was a bird way off course from Arizona, New Mexico. And he was hanging out in my count circle area for a very long time before he did made a jump down towards Provo and Spanish Fork Canyon. And so if that bird was around, I may pass out and die. It would be the most insane thing. That's cool that we did spot it. You know, we do have these Utah Rare Bird Alerts. So if anybody wants to nerd out, you can check out the Utah Rare Birds on the Facebook page. It's very fun. And there's a Utah Rare Birds website. And so people, if you've ever watched, you know, The Big Year, I highly recommend that movie. Hilarious. It also explains how crazy we birders are and how much we love what we do. And so if we saw a crested caracara, I may die. And we have had this occasional snow bunting, which are very cute and just beautiful all in their own right. And so when we've had really crazy winters, we've had snow bunting. So I'd really like for my snow bunting to come back. That would be really great.
Well, fingers crossed for you.
Thank you. Yes. And hopefully the Wasatch Front, you know, you should be getting, some really good birds too. This weather that we had, you know, this week, hopefully pushed in some new birds for people to see. So fingers crossed for the rest of the state to have some really good, really good sightings.
Absolutely. Well, Tanya, thank you so much for sharing about this. Anything else you want to add today?
No, if anybody has any questions, please contact a regional wildlife office. And we look forward to continuing on our bird watching journey with you.
Sounds good. Tanya, thank you so much.
Thanks, Grace.